Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi there. Welcome to New Books in East Asian Studies, part of the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Lori Dickmeyer. I just finished speaking with Dr. Philip Tai from Northeastern University about his new book, China's War on Smuggling, Law, Economic Life, and the Making of the Modern State, 1842 to 1965. It recently came out this year in 2018 with Columbia University Press. His new book deals with China's war against smuggling from the late Qing to the early years of the Chinese Communist state and beyond. This study highlights three issues: the expansion of the state through economic interventions, the changing definition of what constituted licit and illicit commerce, and the ways that government control over the economy impacted the everyday lives of individuals, merchants, and communities. Drawing from a rich array of sources, including customs records, legal cases, press reports, and literature, Tai provides a fresh, insightful take on the development of the modern state during a period of dramatic change in China. It was a pleasure to read his book and speak with him about it. Please enjoy the interview. Hello, welcome back to New Books in East Asian Studies. I'm your host, Lori Dickmeyer. Today, we'll be talking to Philip Tai about his book, China's War on Smuggling, Law, Economic Life, and the Making of the Modern State, 1842 to 1965. Philip, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Lori. Very happy to be here.
Could you start us off by telling us a little bit about your background?
About my background, sure. Well, I am an assistant professor of history at Northeastern University in Boston, specializing in modern Chinese, East Asian, legal, and economic history. I was originally born in Hong Kong, but I really consider myself a Californian. I grew up in California. I received my BA in history at UC Berkeley, and I received my PhD in history at Stanford. The main intellectual pillars of my life have always been history and economics. And like many academics, my research interest is intimately tied to my personal biography. History, in fact, was actually one of my favorite subjects growing up. I was one of those history nerds who liked to read his history textbook. And growing up in California, almost all the history classes I took were American and European history, which I really enjoyed. But by the time I went to college at UC Berkeley, I was very much eager to get in touch with my cultural roots. So when I arrived at UC Berkeley, I took full advantage of all the China-related and East Asian-related courses the school offered. I took Chinese language courses, Chinese history classes, Chinese philosophy classes. I studied abroad in China and so forth. Now, as for economics, economics was another lifelong interest of mine. Growing up, I devoured magazines like Business Week, The Economist. These were magazines that my father subscribed to. I also had some professional experience outside the academy between my time as an undergraduate and my time as a graduate student. I spent actually several years working in the private sector, working in consulting, working in finance. So when I finally decided to enter graduate school, I felt that studying Chinese economic history would be sort of the most ideal convenient vehicle to combine my different interests.
And how did you come specifically to write a book on China's war on smuggling.
Well, that's a very interesting question. As for the research topic specifically, I never really had any sort of personal fascination with smuggling or crime. Like other academics, I came into my research topic by pure luck, pure serendipity. China's War on Smuggling is essentially an expansion of my doctoral dissertation, which I had completed in 2013 under the supervision of my advisor, the Chinese legal historian Matthew Summer. Originally, the scope and coverage of the dissertation, which was much more modest. So I spent several years revising a few chapters, adding a few chapters, conducting additional research before I finally published it in June 2018. I originally came into that topic when I kicked off my fieldwork in China many years ago. When I arrived in China to conduct research for the dissertation, I had this sort of vague plan, this vague idea that I would write this global history or this economic history of trade in Southeast China. And during those early days in the archives, I was poring over many records, many catalogs, looking through a lot of materials. As I was doing so, however, I kept coming across materials or catalog headings related to smuggling or anti-smuggling, just one after another. And initially, when I encountered all these materials, my reaction was actually one of annoyance. I remember thinking to myself that I did not want to look at smuggling. I wanted to look at trade, you know, the idea that it was not related, that smuggling was not related to what I was looking at. But of course, it slowly dawned on me that smuggling is trade. It's just not trade that is legal. And once I had that epiphany, I began to see smuggling everywhere, not just because it was widely practiced, but it was also very widely discussed. And as I continued with my research, I also discovered and realized that smuggling intersected with many key issues in modern Chinese history, whether you're talking about the development of the modern state, the expansion of state authority, the transformation of everyday life. So smuggling was a very important driver of many changes. And as I've said in my book, smuggling may have operated on the margins of the law, but it was far from marginal in driving some important trends in modern Chinese history.
Certainly. Could you tell us a little bit more about the sources that you used for this study, since you referenced those? You make the point several times in your book that smuggling can be a difficult topic to study because of its illegality. So given that, what kinds of sources were you looking at?
I think that there was a historian who once said that the goals of a smuggler is to not appear in the archives. You know, the smuggler who appears in the archives is a bad smuggler because he got caught or his activities were uncovered. So it's very difficult and somewhat elusive to study a topic like smuggling, because many criminologists, many historians of crime have been concerned with the so-called dark figure of history. You know, these are activities that normally fall outside the purview of the public gaze or the official gaze. So I had to use a diverse set of materials. So very generally speaking, I use materials I considered quote unquote official sources, sources produced by the state. The core materials that I employ are customs records. Customs records are mostly produced by agents, customs agents, bureaucrats who are normally at the front lines of this campaign against smuggling, or people who are very much who have very much a firsthand experience in seeing trafficking, and their archives contain everything from reports on ordinary trading activities, on specific smuggling incidents, on intelligence reports, and so forth. I also employ other official sources like legal cases. Legal cases are very interesting in the sense that they show what the state thought was illegal, how they try to define that definition, and how they try to enforce that definition in the courtroom. So these official sources in some ways tell us how what the imperatives of the state were and how they try to push and enforce that imperatives. As for non-official sources, sources I try to use to round out the different perspectives, I include materials like newspaper articles, magazine articles, political cartoons, and even literary fiction. Again, these sort of non-official sources can give us different perspectives than the ones that are produced by the state. And they can also give us insights as to how ordinary people viewed smuggling. You know, did their opinions accord with or differ from that of the state, and other, and they also may talk about smuggling in very interesting ways. For instance, even if the officials or customs agents can't seem to get a handle on who was actually conducting smuggling, there are many journalists, many writers who actually might be able to say something about that, say something about these activities. So it's very important for me when I was trying to put this project together to consult this very diverse array of materials to make sure that I understand what the state said, but also to not fall into this sort of state-centered perspective by consulting sources outside the purview of the state.
Right. So let's dig right into the meat of your book now and start with chapter one. So here you begin your study with coastal commerce and the treaty port era in China. So I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about why you started at this period in time and what kinds of features of the unequal treaties were interesting for you to trace?
Sure. Well, the book is essentially a legal and economic history of smuggling on the China coast from the mid-19th century to the mid-20th century under different Chinese regimes, the Qing Dynasty, the Republic of China, and the People's Republic of China. This period included seminal events like the decline and fall of Imperial China, the creation of the Chinese Republic, the outbreak of the Second World War, the Chinese Civil War, the Communist Revolution, and so forth. And I chronicle in my book the many changes in smuggling, how it was practiced, how it was perceived, and how it was suppressed during the entire period. Now, smuggling itself for me was a very fascinating topic, and I unearthed many, many vivid episodes. And these episodes are really are as interesting as they are sensational, and I'm very impressed by how ingenious, how entrepreneurial people can be in trying to evade laws. But the reason why I also think that it's important is that smuggling is essentially a state-defined crime. It is whatever the state says it is at any given time, and how they define it usually starts with laws. And laws during the treaty port era, in many ways, is shaped not just by domestic Chinese laws, but also by foreign treaties. Because during this period, when from the late 19th century onward, China had to sign a number of foreign treaties after the defeat of the Opium Wars. And these treaties severely constrained Chinese authority in many different ways. For instance, China had to accord foreigners living in China extraterritoriality, meaning that the foreigners in China were immune from domestic Chinese laws. They were under the jurisdiction of foreign laws. Another important feature of the unequal treaties was that China lost its right to set its own tariffs. It had to fix its tariffs on foreign goods at a very low rate. Both of these features of the unequal treaties, the introduction of extraterritoriality and the deprivation of tariff autonomy, these two features of the unequal treaty shaped the way commerce, whether you're talking about legal or illegal, it shaped how commerce was conducted from the late 19th century all the way to the early 20th century. So in order for me to figure out what was smuggling, I had to find out what the legal framework was. And what the legal framework was during this period was very complicated and very much tied to, again, domestic laws, changes in domestic laws, and changes in the international, these foreign treaties that China had to sign. So that is why I had to start with the treaty port era in the late 19th century, going all the way to the early 20th century.
During this period, you also make a note that there was a new development, not just with these treaties, but with the creation of something called the Chinese Maritime Customs Service in 1854. So could you talk a little bit about the importance of that institution and the impact it had on commerce and smuggling on the China coast?
Sure. Well, the creation of the Chinese Maritime Customs Service was the Chinese Maritime Customs Service was a institution that was operated by foreigners, mostly foreigners, throughout most of its existence. But it reported to the central Chinese state, whether it was the Qing court or the Republican government. And it existed from the 1850s all the way to the end of the Communist Revolution. So it existed for almost 100 years. And it was very important because it was one of these institutions that managed, collected, and regulated collected tariffs and managed foreign trade on behalf of China. And it was an institution that was notable for its longevity. There are no comparable institutions in Chinese history from the mid-19th through the mid-20th centuries that had existed continuously. So its records, its operations were very much complete, and these materials actually provide considerable wealth for historians. In the past, historians have used the records of the Chinese Maritime Customs, which included many things from things like annual trade statistics to annual trade reports. And the Chinese Maritime Customs, in addition to being in charge of collecting tariffs and managing foreign trade, it also had at different points in its operations managed the postal service. It managed, collected data on weather, climate. It produced all these reports on random topics like the like opium, cotton, and so forth. So this was an institution that was very big, very expansive in its operational scope, and it was very important to my research because it was the agency, the number one agency on the front lines of the campaigns against smuggling, and it was very important in how it in order to understand smuggling, in order to understand how the Chinese government sought to enforce these forces anti-smuggling laws, we had to look at the Chinese Maritime Customs Service. And there is actually considerable research interest in the Chinese Maritime Customs Service lately because of the archives that has opened up in recent years. And researchers have been able to mine these rich archives to look at a variety of topics. So I just happened to look at smuggling, but there could be other opportunities for other scholars to look at, for other opportunities in research topics for other scholars as well.
And one last thing about this chapter is that you note that low tariffs created by the unequal treaties shaped the type of commodities that were being smuggled during this time. So could you talk a little bit about that development?
Sure. The main development that I try to trace and during this long period is that during the treaty port era, during this era when China was constrained by the unequal treaties, it had to maintain tariffs, again, very low at a rate of roughly 5% on almost all foreign imports, with the exception of a very few imports. And during this period of low tariffs, it simply didn't really make a lot of sense for smugglers to try to smuggle certain goods. I mean, in the sense that there were a lot of smuggling going on, but if you really wanted to make money as a smuggler during this time, you wanted to smuggle goods that were either heavily taxed or expressly prohibited. And generally speaking, during this era of low tariffs, the goods that smugglers really wanted to traffic were goods like narcotics, like opium, which was heavily taxed, commodities or items like weapons, which was, again, prohibited, and items like salt. Salt was a government monopoly. Everything else might have been trafficked, but it just didn't really make a lot of sense. You're not really making that much money when you try to smuggle some ordinary commodity. And from the perspective of the state, certainly there were many customs officials who tried to crack down on run-of-the-mill smuggling, but the attention of most state officials was directed at fighting the smuggling of the three commodities I talked about, narcotics, weapons, and salt, because again, these were the commodities that the state had an interest in regulating. Again, either these commodities were heavily taxed, meaning that this was money that the state was depending on, or they were expressly prohibited, meaning that the state did not want them in coming into to China. And so during this treaty port era, during this era of low tariffs, basically the goods that were most frequently and most profitably trafficked were these three commodities. This does not mean that there were no smuggling of other goods, but that these three goods were the focus of both smugglers and by state agents. But this, of course, all changes later on, which I'm sure we'll talk about very soon.
So moving on to your second chapter, you come back to this idea that the unequal treaties shaped the coastal economy through the two features which you've mentioned, extraterritoriality and the deprivation of tariff autonomy. And in this chapter, you're turning more to the intellectual debates that happen about smuggling and about tariff autonomy. So I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about what those debates looked like first among the literati during the late Qing and then in these more public debates during the early Republic.
Sure. The reason why I actually thought had to look at the issue of tariff autonomy is that when I was writing this book on smuggling, tariffs were very central to driving what smuggling was. If something was heavily taxed, it was likely to be frequently smuggled. And so as a result, I had to actually look at the history of the tariff in China. And I had to actually try to also understand what did people think about the tariff? How did they react to China's deprivation of tariff autonomy? When people look at this period of Chinese history, most people in China today, when they think about the unequal treaties, they will remember extraterritoriality. This image of the foreigner coming into China, committing crimes with impunity, and being able to escape the reach of Chinese law. And that is definitely not exactly completely inaccurate. But the other pillar of the unequal treaty system, the treaty port system, was the deprivation of tariff autonomy. And this is something that most people don't remember as well. And so I decided to sort of dive into this history. And I discovered that even though today, most people, when they think of the unequal treaties, they think of extraterritoriality. They don't really think about the loss of tariff autonomy. When you go back to the late Qing, many officials, many literati, many thinkers of the late Qing, they actually thought that tariff autonomy, the deprivation of tariff autonomy, was far more important far more of a constraint on Chinese authority than extraterritoriality. They thought at the time that, you know, we can let them foreigners manage the foreigners, like go ahead and let the British consuls deal with Britons on Chinese soil. But in the meantime, the court really needs money, and we need to raise money through tariffs. So during this period in the late Qing, there were many Chinese thinkers, officials who were beginning to become concerned that this tariff was constraining finances, and there was a growing appreciation of the fact that many other countries, particularly in the West, were able to promote domestic industrialization or promote their economies by using the tariff as sort of this weapon. And this reflects also late 19th century economic thought in China. Many thinkers at the time would have this thinking and orientation that we might consider mercantilist, you know, using the levers of state policies to promote exports, to minimize imports. So the tariff was, the deprivation of tariff autonomy was very much of an issue for these officials. But when you look into the 20th century, you start to see, when you look at public discussions in newspapers and magazines, you begin to see that ordinary people began to look at the deprivation of tariff autonomy through nationalistic lenses. Qing literati, Qing officials in the late 19th century saw this as sort of a fiscal problem. But by the early 20th century, many ordinary people, many public intellectuals began to see the deprivation of tariff autonomy as a nationalistic issue. Like, this is that China cannot become a normal, quote unquote, a normal country until it has the right to set its own tariffs. So in addition to being an economic problem or a policy problem, it became a national problem by the early 20th century. And then by the time that the nationalists come into power, the nationalists led by General Chiang Kai-shek unify many parts of China in 1928. By that time, right before the onset of the Great Depression, there is also a change in orientation in thinking, not just in China, but around the world. This idea that states could and should exercise more control over their economies. And the deprivation of tariff autonomy was a very serious constraint for states to control their economies. I mean, if a state can't use a tariff to calibrate its imports and exports, it really can't control its economy. So basically, the second chapter traces this very long history of the tariff from something that was once a concern amongst a very elite but very small group of officials and literati to a public issue, a public concern, a problem for the nation.
Right.
And how it.
Sorry. Mm-hmm. You do that in this chapter all the way up to 1928 when tariff autonomy is eventually achieved. Then in chapter 3, you look into what does the legal context look like during the Nanjing decade. When the nationalists make some significant changes to the tariffs and making them higher. So I'm wondering now if you can turn to how the enforcement of smuggling changed during the Nanjing decade as a result, and how does the national government change its laws?
Sure. So basically, much of what I've described about the Treaty Port era, this period of low tariffs, China being constrained by these unequal treaties, this begins to change starting in 1928, when again the nationalists take power. They become the internationally recognized central government of China. Their actual control over the rest of China is pretty tenuous, but at least from the perspective of the international community, they are quote unquote China's government. They are the first sort of they represent the first regime to have some semblance of central authority since the collapse of the imperial dynasty back in 1911, 1912. And more importantly, this government begins to try to institute all these policies to try to modernize China, modernize the Chinese state, modernize the Chinese economy. And one of their first accomplishments was to recover China's tariff autonomy. They did so through diplomatic negotiations. They actually, these negotiations actually drag on for several years. But this recovery of China's tariff autonomy begins in 1928, and the nationalist government begins to introduce tariffs on imports over successive rounds. And these increases in tariffs were not trivial. In many cases, these tariffs, which were again roughly fixed at 5%, they begin to rise by double to triple digit rates, anywhere from 10%, 20%, 40%, 100%, 150%, and so forth, depending on the commodity. And the nationalists also began to introduce more restrictions on commercial regulations to better control foreign trade. Now, these policies, from the perspective of the governments, certainly were very beneficial. These higher tariffs helped raise money. Tariffs during the first 10 years of the nationalist government, the Nanjing decade that you referred to, tariffs during this period made up anywhere from 40 to 70% of the government's revenue. So this is a very serious source of their funding. These higher tariffs, these more restrictive policies also helped fulfill a strategic aim for the government. Chinese leaders had long envisioned a modern China with an industrialized economy, and that this industrialized economy would be guided by the central state. And to realize this vision, of an industrialized China with a strong state, China, in the minds of these officials, had to protect and nurture its domestic industries. It had to, again, control imports and exports, and had to discipline consumers, trying to encourage them to buy more domestic goods and discourage them from buying foreign goods. Now, again, from the perspective of the government, higher tariffs, more restrictive policies are great, but for everyone else, whether these people were consumers or businesses, these policies simply meant higher prices and less commercial freedom. They were people, again, consumers, businesses, were essentially forced to underwrite the nationalist policies by paying more for imported foreign goods, or being forced to change their patterns of consumption. And then suddenly, with this change in policies, with higher tariffs, more restrictive trading policies, the incentives for smuggling increased dramatically. Again, when tariffs were at 5%, the incentives, the profits to smuggle were not really great. But when tariffs rose dramatically, again, anywhere from, you know, from like 10% to like 100, 150% now at this rate, the incentives and profits to smuggle were enormous. And very soon, a smuggling epidemic broke out along the China coast as everyone rushed to profit from this voracious demand for cheap, quality smuggled goods. And then faced with this smuggling epidemic that it created with its own policies, the nationalist government embarks on a very expansive, very coercive, and very violent anti-smuggling campaign. And the government would send its state agents to aggressively crack down on illegal trade. These state agents conducted much more invasive searches on ships, on trains, in homes, in businesses, and on travelers. And most importantly, the government also passed more restrictions on commerce, more draconian laws against smuggling. Before 1928, the punishments related to smuggling, unless you're talking about smuggling of weapons, of narcotics, and so forth, people were usually, if violators were usually fined, or they might have their goods confiscated. But after 1928, laws, we can see, progressively become harsher. Smuggling becomes also criminalized. Duty evasion becomes criminalized. So the general trend that you see starting from 1928 is a government that's taking smuggling much more seriously. It is taking enforcement much more seriously. It is writing new laws that would criminalize behaviors that before were not really criminalized. Now, all of these efforts would steadily help the central government broadcast and assert its authority, essentially giving it the power to define and enforce what it considered to be legal trade. Both, you know, they can define and enforce these definitions both on the ground and in the courtroom. So that chapter, chapter three, basically traces this dramatic expansion of state authority after the nationalists began to recover tariff autonomy.
Something that I found kind of interesting in this chapter was that you suggest that the nationalist government is using these new tariffs and harsher enforcement to combat extraterritoriality. I wonder if you could explain that.
Sure. So basically, the nationalists were able to get rid of, they were able to recover China's tariff autonomy in 1928. They also wanted to sort of get rid of the other pillar of the unequal treaties, of the treaty port order, which was extraterritoriality. However, the nationalists were not able to do so until 1943. Foreign powers were much more willing to grant China its right to set its own tariffs. They were less willing to subject their own nationals on Chinese soils to Chinese laws. So in the meantime, as the nationalists were negotiating with foreign powers to eliminate extraterritoriality, fighting smuggling in some ways sort of pushed against these constraints, pushed against this these extraterritorial privileges by foreigners by through enforcement, because through enforcing anti-smuggling laws, every time state agents try to, let's say, confiscate, let's say, a Japanese trawler, a Japanese boat for carrying smuggled goods, every time they try to fine a foreign businessman or business person from importing smuggled goods, or every time Chinese agents would try to enter a foreign concession to try to arrest a Chinese smuggler, they had to negotiate these very complicated issues of jurisdiction and try to assert Chinese authority, push Chinese authority into foreign enclaves, or try to extend Chinese authority over foreigners on Chinese soil. This is a phenomenon that the Chinese historian, the great Chinese historian Frederick Wakeman, called asserting sovereignty through policing. Basically, by demonstrating authority on the ground, they were able to sort of push back these extraterritorial privileges by asserting the right of Chinese authorities to enforce Chinese laws on Chinese soil on everyone, regardless whether they were foreigners or Chinese. They were not always successful. In fact, many of these efforts were were very much frustrated by foreign powers, by foreign businesses, and so forth. But nonetheless, every time, during this campaign against smuggling, the nationalists were able to sort of successfully and incrementally advance and expand Chinese authority over over foreign concessions and over foreigners in China. So the fight against smuggling, I argued, was this sort of hidden story, or this sort of unknown story about the eventual demise of extraterritoriality. I mean, the whole general narrative of extraterritoriality was that it was introduced in China in 1842, and it was not abrogated, was not annulled or dismantled until 1943, this so-called 100 years of humiliation. But in my book, I try to point out that as Chinese officials were trying to enforce these anti-smuggling laws, they were trying to dismantle this treaty port order from the bottom up.
And that's a good seg into your next chapter, which talks about looking at these bottom-up practices, particularly from smugglers, and even in the public, the kind of response that there is to smuggling. But you actually begin this chapter by looking at how new policies impacted three commodities in particular, rayon, kerosene, and sugar. I'm wondering if you could talk to us about perhaps one of those examples.
Sure. Basically, what I try to do throughout the book is to look at changes in government policies, whether it's through the tariffs, whether through laws, through regulations, prohibitions, and so forth, and see how they how these changes translated into new definitions of smuggling and how they may have translated or translated into the incentives for smuggling. So this chapter where I begin to look at smuggling from the perspective of consumers, businesses, and the public, what I try to do is try to understand how these new tariffs basically change the calculus of smuggling. As I mentioned before, the most profitably trafficked commodities before the before 1928, before China recovered its tariff autonomy, generally speaking, were narcotics, weapons, and salt. These commodities remain profitably trafficked. Smugglers continue to move these commodities. They continue to make money off of these commodities. But after 1928, when the nationalist government raised tariffs on scores of ordinary consumer products, all of a sudden it became very profitable for smugglers to move, let's say, sugar or kerosene or rayon being this material, this fabric that was used for clothes, when these tariffs were double digit, even triple digit range. I mean, if you were a smuggler, you could, yes, indeed, smuggle, continue to make money smuggling weapons, smuggling drugs, but these commodities are very difficult to come by, and also they were very dangerous to traffic. But if you wanted to smuggle sugar, which is completely, it's legal. It's not, sugar itself is not illegal. It's just heavily taxed. What you could do is just buy sugar in a place like Hong Kong, which remained a British colony throughout this period, and then somehow get it over the border into mainland China, into China itself. And then you can avoid paying all these punitive duties, these taxes, and then sort of sell it at a cheaper price compared to those people who had imported goods legally and had to pay the tariffs and had to pass on that cost onto the consumers. So what I do in this chapter is I begin to look at these three commodities. These three commodities were the most were among the largest imports into China, and they also were the most popular imports. These were the imports that were also characterized by what economists might call inelastic demand, meaning that demand that was fairly stable, that did not really change a lot with increases in prices. They were consumed on an everyday basis by consumers and by businesses. So for instance, one of the commodities that I looked at was kerosene. Kerosene was this product that was used to light Chinese homes. This was used for all sorts of purposes. And after the nationalist government tried to raise tariffs on kerosene, it was also trying to promote domestic kerosene market. It also saw that the demand for kerosene by taxing it, that could create a steady supply of money for the government. After the introduction of these tariffs, all of a sudden you had all these traffickers trying to import smuggled kerosene. And it's really interesting because you see importers like one of the biggest importers of kerosene into China was the American oil company, Standard Oil. And it complained. One of the strangest things was that these companies complained about how this influx of foreign of smuggled kerosene undercut their legitimately imported kerosene. So again, looking at these commodities help us try to understand how government policies change the calculus of smuggling, and also it gives us a sense of how individual consumers felt about these increased taxes.
And in this chapter, you also talk about the countermeasures that smugglers took in the face of these stricter policies and higher tariffs. Could you talk about some of those?
Sure. In this chapter, what I wanted to do was to provide an opportunity for to sort of flip that perspective, the state-centered perspective. You know, instead of looking at smuggling from the top down, looking at it from the bottom up, looking at how smugglers operated. And one thing that I was struck by when I was doing my research was that on the one hand, you had a state that was expanding its enforcement capabilities. It was investing considerable resources in arming its agents and buying them the latest technologies in communications, building bigger ships, and so forth. But in the face of this expansion of state authority, in the face of this expansion of enforcement capabilities, the smugglers themselves also took these so-called, what I called countermeasures of evasion, of obfuscation, of resistance, these measures to try to counter, try to deflect state, how the state was beginning to crack down on smuggling. And the measures I describe in the book I found them to be very fascinating, because you had businesses that very smartly try to do all sorts of things to cover up their tracks. They would try to cooperate with middlemen to import goods that would try to evade the attention of customs officials. They would try to, for instance, when the Chinese government begins to invest considerable resources in building this very expansive, very technologically sophisticated wireless network of radios, to help customs officials communicate with one another, the smugglers themselves would build their own mirror communications network to eavesdrop on this communications network, or just communicate amongst themselves. So effectively, these sorts of measures would sort of nullify the advantages of the state. Other measures included something as simple as posting lookouts at various custom stations, so that when the customs patrol boats sail out, someone would fire a flare, would notify other smugglers that the ship was out, and they would adjust their activities accordingly. So the main point that I make here in looking at this is understanding how smugglers themselves could engage in asymmetrical countermeasures to be able to cheaply, effectively, and consistently match these measures produced by the state to try to cover up their tracks to continue smuggling.
And you also talk about the kind of popular response to the smuggling epidemic in popular media, which has a lot of unease surrounding it, anxiety, but also it seems at times it's somewhat critical of the state as well. Could you perhaps talk to us about that? And in particular, I was interested in the image that people had in their minds of women smugglers in particular. So we have this image of the smuggler being mixed with the image of women, and that's particularly anxiety inducing for the Chinese public, it seems.
Yes. So when I looked at this period, trying to understand what did the public think of smuggling, on the one hand, you could say, well, everyone, obviously Chinese consumers voted with their wallets, they're buying smuggled goods, so they obviously didn't think that smuggling was a bad thing. I mean, if they're buying smuggled goods, they obviously didn't care about what the government was saying about smuggling's harm to the nation, to the government's finances, and so forth. And that is certainly one perspective that I think is accurate. I mean, many Chinese consumers voted with their wallets. They bought smuggled goods. But to say that they bought smuggled goods, therefore they didn't care about nationalism, I think that it from looking at all these writings, these political cartoons, I think that it also overlooks a very pervasive social sense of unease, because smuggling, even though many consumers did willingly buy smuggled goods, there were many thinkers who looked at this outbreak of lawlessness, from their perspective, with a lot of apprehension, because many of these smuggled goods were coming from places like Japan, which was at the time a geopolitical rival of China. And as a result, you had many thinkers, many public intellectuals, very much expressing unease at how there were a lot of Chinese consumers who seem to blindly want to just buy any kind of foreign products, supporting, illegal activities, and supporting gangs, and eventually having this money that they use to purchase foreign goods, instead of going it to domestic industries, it goes to foreign companies. So you see that anxiety expressed again through a lot of writings during this period. I was surprised at the number of political cartoons that I've saw, which I also provided in the book, trying to liken smuggling as a form of foreign invasion. This idea that smuggling is just one way for geopolitical rivals like Japan or foreign powers to extend their control over China. As for the women smugglers that you mentioned, when I was looking at smuggling during this period, I think that there was really interesting how smuggling highlighted this gendered dimension. Because during this period, you had many women who were engaged in smuggling. One of the most widely reported incidents were women, poor women, impoverished women, basically trying to eke out a very precarious living, trying to smuggle certain goods from port to port. So you'd have women, one of the favorite ruses that they have is to pretend that they're pregnant, strapping a lot of smuggled goods around their belly. And then, of course, trying to fool inspectors, or carrying babies that were not actually babies, but bags of, say, sugar, disguised as babies, trying to smuggle these goods. Women smugglers were particularly effective because many of the enforcers were men, and women smugglers, women traffickers were able to sort of use the social taboo against the invasion of the a woman's privacy as sort of a shield. And so during this period, as you had many women engaged in smuggling, they became much more visible in the public eye. This isn't to say that there were no men smugglers or that women did not engage in smuggling beforehand. Of course they did. It's just that during this period that as women were also entering the workforce into factories, the office space. One historian called this entrance of women into the public sphere as meriting considerable anxiety, generating considerable public anxiety. And during this period, also women would partake in smuggling. So this only exacerbated prevailing social anxieties about this changing role of women. And also, it's very interesting to note that within some of the popular magazine articles, some of the political cartoons, as well as some of the literary fiction, there was also discussion of smuggling and women. There was this one political cartoon in my book that likened smuggling merchants who engaged in smuggling as akin to a man engaging in the services of a prostitute and so forth. So there's these really interesting gender dimensions that I try to explore, try to at least sort of throw light on.
Right. It's fascinating stuff. If we can turn now to your fifth chapter and perhaps also your sixth chapter, this is when you talk about how smuggling and its enforcement changes during first the Second Sino-Japanese War from 1937 to 1945, and then also during the Chinese Civil War until 1950. I'm wondering if you can talk a bit about your findings about those kinds of changes that occur during those periods.
Certainly. During this period of war, during the Second Sino-Japanese War and then during the Chinese Civil War, historians in the past, looking at this period, have tried to look for either the seeds of nationalist defeat. After all, the nationalists were eventually defeated by the communists in 1949. They've actually looked at this period as a time that the national state was collapsing, or that the communists were building its network, eventually able to prevail over its rival. And I think those narratives within the modern Chinese history community, that has actually undergone some reassessment. Now, historians looking at this period have remarked about how the Chinese state, the national state, was indeed besieged, was indeed under great pressure, but even under such pressures, it was able to build a great bureaucracy that extended economic controls in all sorts of ways. And looking at smuggling was something that allowed me to sort of add something to this ongoing conversation. Because in the past, when historians have looked at smuggling during the Second Sino-Japanese War or in the Chinese Civil War, they've done so with the assumption that this represented the beginning of the end, or just another symptom of nationalist decay or nationalist collapse. And I don't dispute that per se, but what I do want to point out is that during this period, the nationalist government actually introduces a raft of regulations, laws, trying to control the flow of commodities. I mean, they try to escalate all these controls that they were trying to introduce during the first 10 years of their rule, this Nanjing decade. These controls escalate further during wartime. During wartime, the nationalist government would pass new laws that would nationalize certain commodities, and they would try to retain some of these wartime controls into the post-war or the post-war era, right after the Second Sino-Japanese War, into the Chinese Civil War. And many of these controls, many of these regulations would themselves be taken over by the communist government. So during the wartime, during the Second Sino-Japanese War, during the Chinese Civil War, there was considerable amounts of smuggling because the nationalist government was trying to assert its control over different facets of the economy. And of course, it was also encouraged by the conditions of warfare, the material deprivation, the great changes in supply and demand, and so forth. And so, for instance, in the one finding that I have remarked upon in my chapter on smuggling during the Second Sino-Japanese War was this phenomenon of quote-unquote trading with the enemy. The nationalist China, even though during the Second Sino-Japanese War it retreated into the West, into Chongqing, and Western China, while the Japanese occupied much of the Eastern seaboard. During this period, there was considerable trafficking between the different sides. Historians in the past who have looked at this have said that this is the sort of, a symptom of nationalist decay, its inability to discipline or monitor its commanders on the front. I don't dispute that, but what I do want to say, what I do say in the in this chapter is that we have to understand what were some of these drivers of smuggling, and also by putting this into comparative perspective, because when you look at through the annals of history, you'll realize that trading with the enemy, trading between two belligerents who are ostensibly at war, this is actually not a very uncommon phenomenon. I end one of my chapters on smuggling during the Second Sino-Japanese War with these findings by these political scientists who basically looked at 500 years of warfare and concluded that yes, trading with the enemy, whether you're talking about outright warfare, whether you're talking about civil wars and so forth, this is actually a very, very common phenomenon. So in many ways, the nationalists were engaged in something that was no different than what other regimes, other governments, other countries have done in the past. As for the chapter on smuggling during the Chinese Civil War, I do, again, point out some of the problems that the nationalists encountered in trying to rebuild a war-torn economy. The nationalists were trying to rebuild China after 8 years of devastating warfare, while at the same time trying to suppress a communist insurgency. So my chapter on that period basically tries to highlight why smuggling occurred because of the ways that the nationalist regime was trying to continue these wartime controls. And also, I thought it was really interesting in the sense that the collapse of the Japanese Empire after 1945, after World War II, the Second Sino-Japanese War, essentially redrew the map, the political map of East Asia. So you had a lot of trade, which was once considered within the Japanese Empire. Now, all of a sudden, you have trade that was, you know, in this new period when you have, you know, Korea, which was a Japanese colony, gaining its independence, Taiwan, which was a Japanese colony, now belonging to China again. After these massive changes on the geopolitical map, all of a sudden you have also changes in the definition of smuggling. And there's during this period, as again, when the nationalists were trying to fight a communist insurgency, they were also trying to try to figure out, well, how do we establish trading relations with an independent Korea? How do we establish trading relations, or should we establish trading relations with a defeated Japan and so forth? And so during this period when things were in flux, people were not waiting for the Chinese government to reestablish or to legalize formal trade. They were considering, they were conducting their own trade, whether for profit or for survival. And many of these policies were marked as quote unquote smuggling. Another important point that I highlight in the chapter on smuggling in during the Chinese Civil War was gold smuggling. The Chinese government, the nationalist government, tried to impose these controls on the movement of gold. It was very concerned about the influx of gold led to the depreciation of the Chinese currency. And many of these policies actually not just had domestic impact, but it also reshaped the global economy for gold. During 1948, for instance, these policies that the Chinese government introduced basically encouraged gold trafficking on a global scale. And I talk about how basically Hong Kong and Macau became these sort of funnels for the global market for gold, and how Chinese government policies and new international policies encouraged this trafficking.
And we just have a couple minutes left, so I'm wondering if you could tell us briefly about some changes that occur or not changes, perhaps, during the communist rule. So your last chapter looks at the first decade and a half of communist rule and how it deals with smuggling. And also your conclusion briefly touches upon some post-1978 era economic reform developments. So I'm wondering if you can briefly tell us about your main findings from those.
Sure. One of the chapters that I enjoyed writing the most was this the final chapter on smuggling during the early years of the People's Republic of China, the first decade and a half of communist rule. When I began this project, I thought that this chapter would sort of mark the end of this sort of chaotic this smuggling until the reform period after 1978. I remember talking to scholars both in China and in elsewhere about how I wanted to research smuggling, and they basically almost uniformly said, "Oh yeah, there's a lot of smuggling in China before 1948 and after 1978." Smuggling in China when Mao was alive, no way, didn't exist. And I essentially share that assumption until I actually looked at the materials and looked at the sources, and I discovered that my, there was actually a lot of smuggling going on during this this period. And the main point that I make is that there is an an expansive underground economy that sort of opened up even during this period of centralization as the Chinese economy was moving from, moving towards a command economy. There were a lot of opportunities to engage in trafficking, to engage in smuggling. So the point that I make is that there's a lot of continuities. The communist government essentially inherited many of the policies of the nationalist government, their predecessor, and expanded upon it. They retained a lot of these tariffs on foreign goods. They retained a lot of these institutions, and even though they may have changed the names of the institution, they changed some of the people running these institutions, they nonetheless utilized them. And they also maintained these policies of trying to assert state control over the economy. So these all these continuities led to smuggling being being a problem throughout the Maoist period and after 1978 as well. So I wanted to basically look at how things have changed, but how many things have actually remained the same. And I thought smuggling was a really great vehicle to do that.
Well, Philip, we've taken up a lot of your time. You've been very generous about sharing your research with us. So I'd like to wrap things up by asking you a standard question that we ask on this podcast, which is, what are you working on now?
I'm working on several projects. One project is looking at insurance and finance and risk in modern China. This project might get me closer to my interests in economy and finance and so forth. But another project that I'm thinking about is this project that will continue the story of not so much smuggling, but commercial connections or connections between communist China and the rest of what I call Greater China, communist China, nationalist Taiwan, British Hong Kong, Portuguese Macau. The next project I have in mind is to write an economic history of Greater China during the Cold War from 1949 to 1989. During my research for this book, I amassed a lot of materials on commercial relations or just connections between China and elsewhere that I never really used and that never really fit within the book itself. But I like to actually continue that because there are some of these really interesting stories that I think are worth highlighting and worth pointing out that these connections between different parts of Greater China, these economies that were separated by political barriers were actually much more intimately tied and connected than we thought. So that is the other project that I'm looking into.
And Philip, that sounds like a really fascinating project. So I'll keep my eyes open for that one. I'd like to thank you again for being on the show today. I really enjoyed it and I hope you did too. All right, bye-bye.
All right, thank you.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies, part of the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Lori Dickmeyer. Thank you for listening.